Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another fun week of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. In just a second, we've got a fantastic interview. Miranda Marquit from Planting Money Seeds in Adulting is going to be at the helm of this podcast. But first, have you ever wondered if there was a way to capitalize on all that online chatter of the millions of investors out on social media platforms? Well, guess what? Your wait's over, because the same artificial intelligence used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, that's now at your fingertips. You can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index, licensed to an exchange-traded fund, trades under the ticker symbol BUZ, provides investors with a portfolio of securities showing the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. They don't use surveys. There's no guessing. Here's what they do. First, Buzz targets the most mentioned large U.S. stocks across the social media landscapes, and the more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the buzz. Then each of the most mentioned stocks is given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics, and the 75 stocks with the most bullish scores, those are included each month in the index. Invest in the wisdom of crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. Just a disclaimer, I use the Buzz Index in my portfolio. Doesn't mean it's right for you. Do your own homework, but got to tell you that. All right, let's turn this party over to Miranda Marquit.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Today, our guest is Tom Anderson. He is the author of the book, The Value of Debt in Building Wealth. Welcome to the show today, Tom.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Let's get into this. First of all, when we talk about debt, a lot of the time we don't think of it as a wealth building tool. So how do you use debt as a wealth building tool rather than something that's dragging you down?
Well, first of all, all debt is not created equally. So some types of debt absolutely destroy wealth. Some types of debt can be good. And so what I try to do is start by breaking debt into different categories.
Okay, so what are those categories? What is the good debt, and what is the debt that you want to stay away from?
So oppressive debt is debt that has a rate greater than 10%. I want you to eliminate that as fast as you possibly can. So if you have a credit card balance at 20% or a payday loan or anything like that, there's no circumstance where that type of debt is going to be good debt for you. So once you get rid of oppressive debt, what you want to do is, if you have lower interest rate debt, like maybe a student loan or a mortgage, things that I call working debt, or in the best category of debt is what I call enriching debt, that debt you might not want to race to pay down. You want to value the value of liquidity versus eliminating that debt.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I know in my own life, I recently just paid off my car loan. I had a 1.9% interest rate on it, and people thought I was crazy for financing the car to begin with and then not paying it off early. I was like, well, I've got it's a 5-year thing, but it's only 1.9% interest. I can take the money I would use to either just pay for the car outright or pay it down faster, and I can invest that money and get a much better return.
Absolutely. That's a perfect example. And so think about that. Like, if you have $10,000 in the bank that you would have put down on that car instead, and you lost your job or had a medical emergency or any type of thing happened to you, you can ride out a tremendous amount of storms. The second that you take that money and pay it down on the car, you can't get that money back. And so life sends all of us a tremendous amount of curveballs. And I worry that people are so focused on paying down debt, even low interest rate debt, that they don't value liquidity enough. And I want more people to break the paycheck to paycheck cycle and have money in the bank so they can ride out storms that life sends all of us.
Yeah. So now you mentioned liquidity, and that seems, like you said, something that a lot of people overlook. So can you kind of explain to our listeners and to others, what is liquidity and what is the great value in having liquidity in your finances and in your life?
Yeah, so I have life insurance, which is, I think, maybe a good thing, but here's how it works. I pay money into an insurance policy, every year, and if I die, money goes on to my kids. And a lot of people, I think that that's a good trade that makes sense, and I get it. I need to take care of them if I'm not around. But we get the concept of insurance, and you're familiar with that, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay, so there's no form of insurance like money in the bank. That's what I mean by liquidity. If you have $1,000 in your checking account, you have access to $1,000. If you have $10,000, you can ride out a job loss or when the furnace goes out or the roof needs a repair, the more cash that you have on hand, if you have $50,000 of liquidity, which would be a high number, I get it, for a lot of people, but there are very few storms that you can't ride out. And money causes all of this stress and anxiety in people's lives, and I think that the reason it does is because they don't have liquidity. They don't have insurance. They don't have access to money, and that's the cycle that I want to break.
Okay, so how does, you've talked about oppressive debt and getting rid of that, and we've talked a little bit about low interest rate debt and maybe not throwing all your money at it. But how do you use then this debt to promote your liquidity and to start building wealth and get out of these destructive paycheck to paycheck cycles?
Absolutely. So what you want to do is, once we've separated the debt into to different categories, oppressive, you know, working and enriching, your debt that's at a lower interest rate, what most people do is they take on too much debt early in their life. They race to pay it down. And then they wake up when they're 50, 55 years old and they start saving toward retirement. And when you do that, you're not giving your money enough time to work for you. You're missing out on the value of compounding interest over a long period of time. And so what I want to do is basically reverse that and say, hey, let's start building up your portfolio earlier in your life. And then later in your life, you can pay down debt. With that very subtle change, you get a longer period of money compounding for you. It grows logarithmically, and the math behind it is staggeringly compelling.
Right. And when you're talking about paying off this debt later in life, you're not talking about the oppressive debt that you mentioned earlier. You're talking about these other types of debt with the lower interest, and then even the working debt that's actually going to help you accomplish something.
Absolutely. So kind of this is where the book really begins. I have the nadas, the steadies, and the radicals. And the nadas just basically say, I'm going to pay down my debt as fast as I possibly can. That's kind of one framework. The steadies pay it down throughout their life on a normal mortgage, and then they kind of try to save later in life. And the radicals embrace debt throughout their life. Three different things. And we apply some math to it. And what happens is, if you follow the conventional wisdom path that all debt is bad and pay down your debt right away and try to save later, you will not mathematically be on track for retirement. So many people keep saying, why do I not have enough money to retire? Why am I not on track? And the reason is because of conventional wisdom. There's a better path and a better way, and that's what we mathematically prove in this book.
So now we can talk about math, and we could talk about the logic behind it. And I know, like for me with my car example, you know, to me it logically made sense and the math made sense. And so I did this. But a lot of people were looking at me going, oh my gosh, I couldn't do that emotionally. I can't do that. I'm not comfortable. So how do you make that switch? How do you move from saying, okay, I'm not comfortable with any debt to, okay, I am comfortable with some debt and I can use it to better my finances? How do you make that mental switch?
Yeah, I don't know. And I know that I need a better answer to that one. But so, I mean, here's kind of the framework. I think if we think about it from a society perspective, the first thing that we need to do is really look at the math and look at the data. And I think the math and data is compelling, so I put the burden of proof back on conventional wisdom. But what you're saying is so important. It's the behavioral economics. Many people can't process things this way, and they can't digest information that debt could be good. But I think there was a time that people thought that smoking was not only, you know, okay, that maybe it was even potentially good for you, right? And so, and we learned that that's not factually true, that smoking can kill you and cause cancer. And so we've changed behavior as a result of that. I think our society looks at our diet differently today than we did 20 and 30 years ago. I think we look at exercise differently. I think we can look at debt differently as well. I think the data is compelling, and that is what will lead people to see that there's a better way.
Okay. And so if you are talking to somebody who wants to start kind of utilizing, you know, using the value of debt to build wealth for the future, where do they start? What sort of, I guess, what sort of loan do you take out now? But where do you start when you're trying to figure this out?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book is laid out as a very specific and actionable glide path. And I break life into different phases, what I call the launch phase, the independence phase, the freedom, and the equilibrium phase. And so it depends on the phase of life where you are. And I'm not about just taking on debt for debt's sake. That's not what this book is about. What I find is the vast majority of people already have some form of debt. But they don't have a plan with, should I pay down that debt or should I build up my savings? Kind of like what you're saying with the car. People do that with their mortgage, their student loan, their car loan. And people are guessing with these things. My whole thing is there should be no guessing with money. We should be using math and science to come up with what's the best path for us. So what I do is I look at what debt do you have in your life, what cash do you have in your life, what retirement assets do you have, what investment assets do you have, and I give a specific and actionable glide path saying whether or not you should be paying down your debt or building up your savings.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's interesting too, you mentioned the student loans. That's another area where people think I'm nuts, because once again, I have a 1.9% interest rate on my student loans. And of course, the interest that I do pay, which isn't that much, is tax deductible. And so, you know, doing all the math, once again, I see no reason to pay off my student loans early at all. And I'm comfortable carrying that because the math works out for me. But I think that you probably have a little bit of your work cut out for you as you try and convince people to jump on that bandwagon.
You're a genius. I mean, that is exactly what you should be doing. If you have access to money at that low of a rate, don't pay down any amount on it. And the reason is the following. You have a debt to your future self. At some point in your life, if you want to retire, then you have an obligation to build up enough assets to support that future retirement. And so, instead of money going in to that 1.9% debt that's fully tax deductible, what you should be doing instead is building up that retirement account, building up that investment portfolio, and letting that portfolio, you're young, let it cook for you for a long period of time. That ends up being so powerful. Don't give up the liquidity and the power of compound interest for what? For 1.9% tax deductible return? That's absurd. You're doing the exact right thing.
Thanks. No one's called me a genius before, so I'll take it. Thank you so much for joining us today. This was a great insight into kind of a new way to look at debt as a tool, just like many of the other tools in our financial box. Where can our listeners find you? Where should they go looking for you online?
Sure. If you go to thevalueofdebt.com, or you can follow me on Twitter, it's Tom Anderson. That's at it's Tom Anderson.
All right, now it's time to move into the roundtable portion of our show. But first, let's talk a little bit about the Buzz Index and the wisdom of the crowds.
That's crazy talk, Miranda.
Right?
No, I'm kidding. You know what's funny is we talk about the Buzz Index and about this idea of the wisdom of crowds. When Jamie Wise talks about what Buzz tracks and about the wisdom of crowds, what does that mean? I asked him, is it the financial crowd that he's worried about and collecting data from them? Or is it also Billy Bob, who just happens to be somebody who's active on Twitter? Here's what he said.
It's all of the above. This is a big thing for people to get their heads tuned into, because we're so used to watching CNBC all day long, where we have a so-called expert with a microphone in front of him telling us what that stock is about to do. The concept of wisdom of crowds is that you don't have to be an expert. But the collective view of thousands of independent and diverse people, they are able to make a better group collective decision than any one expert within the group. So it's not about one person's opinion. It's about the average opinion from that group.
Very interesting. Linda, is it strange to you that they're not just tracking financial people? Like, even Billy Bob's opinion helps define what they're going to invest in.
Well, I think their concept is to get the most input they can from what's being said online. And so it makes sense that they would take into account everybody's opinion. You know, you have to look at what is the sentiment, right? The sentiment indicators are important.
Yeah, it made me realize that I'm going to have to start talking about Krispy Kreme donuts more often.
Got to bring them to the next time we get together.
That's right. Invest in the wisdom of crowds. Jamie's going to write us about this one. Joe, I really didn't want this to be about Krispy Kreme. Invest in the wisdom of crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information on the Buzz Index. It's some technology that the most sophisticated hedge funds use, and now it's at your fingertips. Ticker symbol BUZZ. disclaimer, I use the Buzz Index myself. Let's go back to Miranda. Miranda, fantastic interview.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And it was really kind of fun because it really helped validate all of the things that I've done in my life. And we all like validation. His take is very interesting in that it goes against the conventional personal finance wisdom that we hear all the time preached everywhere. So what do you guys think about that? Do you think that in a way that in the personal finance space or just in financial advice in general, do you think that we kind of discount the value of debt and using debt in kind of a, I don't know, a savvy way? And let's start with you, Doug. What do you think?
Well, as a traditional kind of guy, I am generally anti-debt. I think the issue is not whether it's theoretically a good idea, because obviously, Miranda, like you were telling him, it is a perfectly good idea if everything works out well. You bought your car and paid under 2% interest on the loan. And as long as you have enough money to put the down payment, and then as long as you're able to save the money you're saving, and as long as you're able to earn money on your investments at more than 2% after tax and fees, great. But there are all sorts of things that if it all works out well, it's fine. And don't forget what my grandfather used to tell me.
Oh, boy.
What did your grandfather used to tell you?
Oh, that boy. If my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a wagon.
I don't even know what that means.
It just means that if everything happens in a certain way, so fine, then you get your wagon. But if it doesn't all line up, then you're going to be you can potentially be in big trouble. And as a personal finance kind of guy, I work with real people, not in the world of theory.
Which beer was Grandpa on when he said that?
Wow. Yeah, I would love to see your grandmother's face. Oh, yeah, okay. I'm a wagon now.
Right. All right. Once I started with the joke, I was kind of regretting it, but I figured I would take it all the way. So thank you for laughing.
And that was the day before the divorce.
So, Joe, what are your thoughts on this? You were a former financial planner. You were in the space. You were doing the thing. What are your thoughts on this idea of using debt to kind of move ahead?
I was in the space doing the thing with my peeps. Is that what you're talking
that's
about?
That's right.
Yeah. You know what's funny is that I have a real issue with this whole argument because I totally believe what Tom's saying, that, you know, you do the math. The math is fantastic. Yes. Leverage the debt, leverage interest rates. Don't worry about paying it off. You know, you look at how companies run their money. You know, the CFO of a company is trying to eke out as much value as they possibly can. And if there's some interest rate arbitrage they can use to do that, that's fantastic. But man, behavior is a bear. And we know that people get into horrible situations when they hear a message like Tom's and they're not ready for it. So for me, it was a two-step process. I had to learn how to live a debt-free lifestyle first and to understand that debt was just a horrible thing because I, as I've said on many former podcasts, I ripped the heck out of my credit right out of college. I had a horrible credit rating. I had tons of debt. I didn't understand just what a lethal weapon that can be. But once I did, and once I got my debt under control and made it work for me, then going to what Tom's talking about with the math, then at that point, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. Kind of baby stepping your way toward that. You can't just sort of flip a switch and make it happen. So
you're saying that your goal was to eventually be the kind of guy who could take on debt, but right. First you had to grow up first. That's what it sounds like. Is that for real?
Well, no, that was actually never my goal. My goal was to have a healthy financial picture. And at the time I realized that meant living a debt-free life, right? So to pay off my debt, to live a cash lifestyle, not spend money unless I had the cash already saved for it. I remember early on, before I learned that lesson, we went to Walt Disney World and I was just married. We did the whole thing on a credit card. I remember feeling horrible the next 6 months. And this was kind of part of my wake up call was I got to get this stuff under control because, you know, paying for Disneyland over 6 months with plus interest, you know, and not a small interest rate. So I guess to answer your question, Doug, I had to first get a healthy respect for debt and get my finances under control. And once I realized then, I'm like, okay, I respect debt. Then I could go, oh, look at these credit card points. I never run a balance on a credit card. I've already touched that stove. I'm not going to do it again. So yeah, now I can start using the stuff again.
So good or bad? Just bottom line, debt is good, debt is bad. that was a good story. I just don't get it. I'm sorry.
I think it's point. I mean, debt's kind of a tool, but you have to know how to use it. Otherwise, it becomes a terrible, horrible millstone. So, I mean, I don't think
I don't think debt's good or bad. I think you're good or bad.
Not as a person, yeah. But with money.
Yes.
No judging.
Yes, or as a person.
No. Okay, well, I have a totally different opinion.
Okay, yes, thank you. Let's move on to Linda. Let's let Linda come in because I need some backup. So come, Linda.
I have a totally different opinion. Okay, I completely agree with Tom. I think he's exactly on track. I don't think debt itself is good or bad. I think there are certain types of debt that are good and bad. And what Joe is describing is consumer debt, which I agree is bad. And unless you have a very low interest rate like Miranda did, which was really smart, a smart use of debt. But when I was young, I wanted to know how people got wealthy. And I spent most of my youth reading autobiographies about millionaires. And what I noticed is that millionaires pretty much always used other people's money, which meant that they had some form of leverage that they used to invest in something that would compound and grow their money. Now, for a lot of people, that turns out to be their home. And, you know, most people buy a mortgage or get a mortgage and don't really think about the fact that it's a positive use of debt. But thank goodness that they did, because 20, 30 years down the road, that's what a lot of baby boomers have in terms of equity for their retirement. And if they didn't have a house, they'd be in a world of hurt. So leverage actually increases our rate of return. It actually causes forced savings if you have it in a positive appreciating asset. Now, I realize that there's a housing bubble and we may be, you know, at the peak of another bubble. So I'm not suggesting that everyone go out and run and buy a house right now, because I think you do have to be conscious about that. But I do think that debt use for the right purpose is a strong financial tool that should definitely be in your tool shed.
For buying a house, anything else? Yeah, or being Miranda,
you know,
and getting
business. 2%. I mean, years ago when I was starting out investing, one of the things I did was I formed a partnership with some friends and we flipped houses. And so that was a positive, we put money in and we were able to get a loan and borrow more. And so that was a positive use of debt because we were investing in something to appreciate, which was Tom's whole point of view was to, I forget the term he used, what he called it, but it was to buy an appreciating asset. And so I think, you know, we've gotten all caught up in debt is bad because there's so much consumer debt that everyone got caught up in at these astronomical high interest rates. And it was, you know, on credit cards. And credit card debt is bad if it's used for purchases and outliving, you know, our means. But leverage for the right reason is a very powerful wealth building tool.
I think, Linda, the only difference between you and I was your ability to receive that message. I grew up in a family, you grew up, you're reading about millionaires. I grew up in a family where we didn't talk about money at all. Whenever there was a money conversation going on at our house, I remember I'd walk into the room and my parents would send me immediately out of the room. My parents had a bunch of consumer debt. I remember them using credit cards for everything. So my ability to receive the leverage message was zero. So I totally agree. And I think that if you're smart with money, you do use leverage. And when I was a financial planner, my wealthiest clients always leveraged appreciating assets and appreciating opportunities.
But other than their house, Joe? Other than their home?
Oh, sure. They would do that on business opportunities all the time. Absolutely. Yeah, if they could take part in a business opportunity and use, like Linda said, somebody else's money to do that. But what's funny is these people knew how to evaluate whether it was a good opportunity or bad opportunity. For me, out of high school, leveraging flipping houses, I would have flipped the wrong house in the wrong neighborhood doing the wrong stuff because I was not prepared for that message.
Yeah, and I think that preparation is definitely key, no matter how you're doing it. And I think the idea comes down to where are you at in your own financial journey? Where are you at in terms of understanding? To Doug's point, too, earlier, you know, he made that really good point. It's like, you know, it's great that I was able to get a 1.9% interest rate. And instead of putting, you know, instead of sinking that money in my depreciating car, you know, I was able to take and put money aside and invest it and get a much better than 1.9% return. So the question is, you know, what's your mindset as you're doing this? What are your thoughts as you're doing this? And are you actually going to put that money into an investment? Or are you going to say, hey, you know, now I've got this chunk of money that I can, you know, I've saved up this money for this car, or, you know, whatever, and now I'm just going to go ahead and finance it instead. Are you going to take the money and blow it on a vacation, or are you going to put some of it, you know, to work on your behalf? And I think that's where the behavioral finance piece of it comes in, and that whole readiness and, you know, moving that direction and being ready to make those choices and have that discipline.
I just wanted to say, Linda, that you explained it so well, and I'm totally agreeing with what you said to differentiate out consumer debt from this. But I also just want to comment that, and this is anecdotal, but, you know, in my business as a financial planner today, I work with lots and lots of millionaires. Other than their homes, and maybe this is just because I have a different kind of business than Joe had, other than their homes, which I agree most people buy with a mortgage, they're not using debt. They're using compound interest and saving and, you know, putting aside monthly and pension plans. And they grow to be millionaires. So I don't want people to walk away from this and go, well, if I'm smart and I read, you know, Daniel Kahneman and learn about behavioral finance, then maybe I'll start buying, you know, index funds on margin, because then I can benefit from OPM, other people's money. And, you know, I can make more than I'm paying in interest, because that's the path to financial destruction for most people.
Right.
Well, it sounds like most of your clients are probably business owners, and business owners are, you know, one of the top groups that create wealth. So, you know, if people aren't a business owner, then I think maybe leveraging is an alternative thing they could do, as long as they're investing in the right assets and being super careful and informed and studying, doing their homework. I think, you know, it's not to say that that's the only way to create wealth. Certainly, if you're a business owner, that's an excellent way to create wealth as well.
And I think one of the things we do need to take into account too is the fact that, you know, Tom wasn't necessarily talking about, you know, rushing to buy things on margin, like buy index funds on margin and, you know, get into that. I think one of the key messages that he had there was, hey, there's no reason, you know, if you've got student loans or if you've got mortgage debt and it's really low interest, there's no reason to like rush to pay it off in the next 5 years at the expense of starting investing and starting to build your wealth over time. So I think that's something to think about as well, is a lot of the time in our society, we have this idea that we have to get rid of all debt immediately now. And then we put off investing until we have some of this low interest debt, that also comes with tax deductions, by the way, in the case of student loans and mortgages. In the case of a student loan, it's above the line. You don't even have to itemize to get that tax deduction. So I think, and that's one of the reasons I still have my student loans and I'm not bothering to pay them off, because they are below 2%. I'm getting a tax deduction for them each year. And instead of paying them off quick, you know, instead of having them paid off right now, you know, I've been able to invest and invest the money I would have put toward paying them down early. So I think that's another thing to think about too, is not so much, all right, let's use some debt to go out and leverage a risky investment, so much as it is, all right, let's take a step back and think about it. And do I have to rush to pay off all of my debt immediately at the expense of maybe, you know, getting started with a, you know, low-key investment plan?
Yeah, I thought Tom made a really good point with that, because I think there is this idea out there that sort of gained popularity in the last several years that all debt is bad, and it's focusing on getting people to pay off their houses early. And Tom's point was, if you pay off your house early, you're going to start saving late for retirement. And that has bothered me as well. I think that is a totally wrong concept for people. You know, the idea that you have to pay off your kids' college, your house, you know, all your debt, and then you can start saving for retirement. I just don't see how people are going to be able to have the time to compound to have a significant retirement plan. And I think they need to start as early as possible saving for retirement and not pay off their house if that's the choice. Leave the mortgage on the house and then, you know, start the retirement fund is what I would suggest.
Well, and there's another point there, Linda, that scares me that he brought up a little bit, which is if you suck a bunch of extra money into your house and you get one payment away from finally getting the house paid off and you have a disability and you're not able to make that last payment, do they just take just a little bit of the house that you still owe away? No, they still take the whole thing. So you're putting money into this asset where, and like he said, life throws you so many curveballs. For me, there's also the fear that, man, if something goes wrong, all this money's locked up in my house. At the very least, I think if you want to pay off your house early, what I would always tell people to do is take that extra money you were going to put toward it. Because, you know, usually this is a 30-year loan, right? So we may have 20 years left or 25 years left on the loan. Over that amount of time, Miranda's strategy of a passive index fund historically has been a fantastic one where you're beating the pants off of the interest rate you're paying on most mortgages. So instead of making that extra payment directly to the mortgage, make it into this fund we call the Pay Off the House Early Fund. And you'll pay off the house even earlier if you want to, which I agree, Linda, it would be a horrible use of money. But you know, you've got the flexibility to pay it off if things go badly, where if you put it right in your house, it doesn't make as much sense.
Right. And your house is not a very liquid thing. I mean, when I sold my house, I had to take a huge loss on it because of how quickly we went through it. So, yeah.
You know, the other thing is we sometimes overlook the fact that we're in such a low interest rate environment. I mean, historically, interest rates have been a lot higher. You know, the norm that the Fed wants to get back to is somewhere in the 6 to 8% range. That's what they're working toward. And, you know, someday I just believe that we're going to look back on this and say, wow, a mortgage at 4%, why wasn't I loading up the bus and, you know, getting the most debt that I could at 4%? Because there are so many other better opportunities longer term to do, you know, to invest money and to grow that money rather than have it, you know, be paying off a 4% debt.
So Doug's been kind of quiet about this. And before we wrap it up, let's hear what Doug has to say.
Linda, I just want to ask you a question because I was agreeing with everything you said, but I'm wondering, and you've said this before, that the Fed's goal is to have a 6 to 8% interest rate. Why do you think that? I understand that the goal of the Fed is to have maximum employment. That's the number one goal. And to have price stability is the number two goal. I don't see it as a number unless there's some report that you've seen that I haven't.
Well, if you look up normalization, that's the term they use to try to get back to this range of where it can be more profitable for banks and the banking system. And so they want to be in a certain range where they think the system really works well, because banks really aren't making much money. I mean, that's why they're not able to make a lot of loans and they're just sort of stagnant and stuck. And so they want to, you know, be able to have their spreads be at a higher level. And so they want to get into this normalization range.
I thought the banks were doing pretty well, and then being in a spread for them, it shouldn't really necessarily matter what the Fed funds rate is because they're just going to mark it up.
Well, they're doing better since interest rates have been rising. Have you noticed that that's why the financials have been rallying, is because interest rates have been going up, so that helps their margins. And so that's exactly what the Fed intends, and they're trying to get that to an even better level.
I'm simply noting that you're pointing out, we don't have to get into the conspiracy of it, that you're suggesting that the Fed's goal is to help profitability of the banks, as opposed to what I thought their goal, which was maximum employment and price stability, which means low inflation.
Okay, we're getting into a thing here where the official job of the Fed is to promote maximum employment and price stability. That is the official job of the Fed.
I'm gonna go grab a beer.
We can stop here if you want.
There are plenty of other theories as to, you know, how the Fed does what it does and why the Fed does what it does.
I mean, I wasn't intending that as a conspiracy theory. I mean, what they do directly impacts banks, and they do oversee that, you know, essentially the banking system. So, because they set important rates for the banking system. So I wasn't implying any conspiracy theory at all, actually.
Okay. So anyway, let's round it up here. What's going on over at Stacking Benjamins, Joe?
We are not talking about Fed policy over there. We have a woman who wrote a great book a couple of years ago called The Monopolists, which talks about the real way that the game Monopoly was created. And it's funny because a lot of us have heard this story about this guy in the early 1900s who, you know, created this game Monopoly and became rich. That's not it at all. The game Monopoly actually traces its roots to a woman, and she had something completely different in mind than what we have today. So Mary Pallon, who's writes for the Wall Street Journal and has written for the New York Times, joins us on the show.
Very cool. And what about you, Linda? What's happening over at Be Wealthy and Smart?
Well, on the podcast, we have a story about Craigslist scams, which was in the news recently, and I thought was very interesting, and I wanted to bring it to people's attention. So we're talking about beware of what's going on Craigslist.
All right. Very cool. And what about you, Doug? What is happening in your world? Goldstein on Gelt or Rich as a King?
Well, in Rich as a King, following from a great discussion we had here on the Money Tree podcast, I spoke recently in episode 135 about how to invest in real estate. And a lot of people want to invest in real estate, but it's just a little more complicated and they don't have good friends like Linda did to make limited partnerships and take on debt. They just want to know, how can I get into that market? And that's what I talk about at richasaking.com. And hey, Miranda, I know you're doing some pretty cool stuff too. What's going on in your world?
Yeah, so over at adulting.tv, we have had a rash of interest in financial stuff. And so even though we've tried desperately to include things other than finances on adulting.tv, we've got a lot of financial stuff right now. We've got stuff about why your finances suck and how to fix it. We have Beth Kobliner, who joined us on the podcast to talk about getting a financial life. And we've got another episode about how to ask for the raise you deserve. So check us out at adulting.tv. There's plenty going on there. And of course, make sure you head over to moneytreepodcast.com for all of our latest podcast episodes. You can get access to some great resources, listen to all of our episodes, and make sure you subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. Send us a question. We've got a questions episode coming up very soon. So make sure you send us your questions so that we can answer them on the air during the podcast, and leave us a review in iTunes so that we know what you really think about us. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.